Open rebellion against Trump threatens as Obama AFO group sends 30,000 trained protesters into the field. In one surreal moment after the next, the American left has allowed itself to be whipped up into a frenzy of righteous anger, rejection of institutions, and a spasm of utter lawlessness. It feels as if the time is coming where progressives will demand that for Americans to be good patriots, they must decide to throw off the reign of Trump. The deranged Barack Obama's community organizing group, Organizing for Action, leads the way. But isn't this choice that between Trump and destroying America, isn't this choice that we're being given one between getting rid of Trump or destroying America? The long liberal infatuation with lawlessness, antinomianism technically, is finally bearing its sickly sweet fruit. For a person to be convinced that they are honoring the law by rejecting it in the name of some higher good is an evil of self-deluded righteousness. And this from the people who angrily reject the notion of a higher law and the law of nature, the law above the law, what we call natural law. So what happens next? While vacationing in some exotic foreign capital with one of his many billionaire pals like Richard Branson, Obama deploys his giant army of protesters to disrupt, distract, and ruin 10,000 events over the next 4 years. And while Trump will refuse to bow to the pressure, the total sense of lawlessness and anarchy will perpetually send out the message that Donald is mean, crazy, or unstable, and certainly without authority or right support. For the left, this then sets the stage, in their minds at least, for the next insurrection, where during the next term, their next term in office, they can finally put the noose around the American eagle and kiss good old USA goodbye. God help us. Good morning. Kelly here, and happy President's Day, which is actually used to be George Washington's birthday, didn't it? So, anyway, here. I was watching some. I'm going to do something about Washington during the show, but let's see here. I've had something on my mind, and what has been on my mind is this crazy. This crazy attempt to get rid of Donald Trump, which is just another, if you know anything about leftism and progressivism, how they go after stuff, it's just another in a series of really sad attempts by the left to try to take over power in various places around the world, and the fact that they can't really get voted into office, but if they do get voted into office, then they're rejected because they're terrible people. And I've got this, I think the computer seems like it's a little bit slow right now, but let me get for you one of the things that really caught my attention. And this is a description. So this is what you've got going on. You've got all this protest out there, and it seems really robust. It seems like these people are very motivated. And it seems to be occurring naturally, right? Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Barack Obama, who bought a house 2 miles away from the Capitol, is coordinating all of this stuff. So as soon as he leaves office, and really even before he left office, he starts working on destroying Donald Trump. Now, my question for you is, and if this turns out to be true, which I think we've already got all the evidence that we need, these OFA, this OFA organization that Obama put together before he went into office, he is always, in my opinion, had this as a plan to pull the trigger on the next person after he left the office, or to pull the trigger on America. And now it became this crisis. And so he's got these 30,000 people that are already signed up for this community organizing group. And they're the ones that are showing up, or at least they're organizing these crowds of people that are all well-dressed and carrying tons of signs. They're coming from OFA, and they're doing it to try to destroy Trump. And if they can't force him out of office, what they want to do is make sure that he can't have any support from the media, from Hollywood, from the political class, from the average citizen. So we have to bear this in mind as all this stuff is happening. Here is just a little clip on this that explains the whole thing.
Erupted over President Trump's refugee executive order. Former President Barack Obama said, quote, he's heartened by the demonstrations. Was that it? Well, our next guest says that was a message to his troops, an army of agitators with one goal, sabotage Trump's presidency. New York Post columnist and author of The Great American Bank Robbery, Paul Sperry, joins us. Paul, you point to Organizing for America. What is Organizing America doing with these protesters, and what's the president linked to that organization?
Yeah, all these protests against Trump, they're not spontaneous. They're pre-manufactured by OFA, and OFA is Obama. OFA is the Organizing for Action. It's a nonprofit that's officially tied to Obama.
But the guy's windsurfing. What is it? Is he really organizing?
Oh yeah, he's behind all these protests that are breaking out across the country. They want you to believe that this is some broad-based sudden uprising against Trump's policies, but it's not. It's just Obama and his radical activists.
How many are involved? How many are involved in OFA?
Well, according to their tax records I looked up, they've got an army of over 32,000 hardcore Alinsky-trained agitators, and they're training thousands more as we speak. They've got a big training summit coming up in March. And so basically Obama is building a shadow government to sabotage Trump at every turn, and he's got an army to do it.
Like when something was up, when Jason Chaffetz wins his district with 73% of the vote, yet at a town hall, 70% of the people at that town hall were screaming at him over Obamacare.
He's in a safe Republican district. Yeah, that wasn't spontaneous, of course. That's all from right out of the training manual that OFA has put out. I've got a copy of it. And they actually have a whole section in here on how to target these town halls and ambush Republicans who go back and hold these town hall meetings. It says, get seated and spread out. Head into the venue a bit early to grab seats at the front of the room, but do not all sit together. Sit by yourself or in groups of two and spread out throughout the room. This will help reinforce the impression of broad consensus.
And if you talk to the administration offline and even sometimes on camera, they are stunned by the amount of uprising, the fact that these protests haven't stopped. You're not, because you know where it starts. You know where the foundation is.
Yeah, I mean, the Trump White House, these Republicans, lawmakers, they are just completely blindsided. They don't know where this is coming from. The opposition and the media say this is organic. It's not organic. This is where this is all coming from. It's coming from Obama. I mean, he's basically set up an opposition government. And boy, I tell you, there's no precedent for this. I mean, this is the first president who's actually staying behind in Washington, at least for the last, within the last 100 years.
And we just touched on the surface, which you've investigated and revealed. Organizing for America, Barack Obama versus Donald Trump. It continues. Thanks so much.
All right, so all of this stuff that's going on, that people want you to think is spontaneous is not spontaneous. This doesn't mean that there's not frustration or anger at Trump, but I mean, you know, when Obama got elected, there was, you know, frustration and anger towards him from some people in the right, but his time in office went on and then, you know, his time is over and he got to do what he wanted to do. And if he didn't get, there's certain things that he didn't do, it's not because it was a bunch of protesters that were shutting things down and putting out this false narrative that America has rejected him. It was because he wasn't organized. He didn't, you know, really study the interaction between the presidency and the Congress and such, has kind of become a famous observation by biographers of his, is that he was kind of lazy. It's all from afar, you know. I don't really know the guy, and you don't either, but it seems to be that for whatever Obama wanted to do, he's continuing on as a private citizen now with even less restraint. We do have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, Kelly, it's Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Did you hear anything about what the Pope was saying about poverty causes crime and stuff like that? He made some statements.
Wait a second. You mean the Pope's a Marxist?
Oh, yes. From Argentina, he used to be a bouncer in a bar.
You did or he did? Was he wearing his white hat then or what?
Get a yarmulke on.
Probably. Okay, well, I'll look into it, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Right, bye-bye. All right, so I identified the Pope as a Marxist a long time ago. Marxism is it's a theory. I've mentioned to you it's a summary of all of the thoughts that were going on in the left at that time. You know, Marx was a collector of other people's ideas. But it's also a theory about how the world runs. It's very simple to understand. People are rich because they steal from the poor. A boss is an enslaver. He is a enslaver of his employees. People sell their soul for money so they can live. They're constantly oppressed. The poor are constantly oppressed. That's it. I mean, it's not factually correct, but what difference does it make, right? So let's I was going to play you some we're having some computer difficulties, but let's take a break. 6:18, we'll be right back. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, same 1450, 523, 1450. Today is the 20th President's Day. We'll be right back. Okay, so I'm getting at what's going on now, the cause of it. It's scary, you know, but I mean, I think that you have to kind of, I guess the saying is gird your loins and get ready for battle. The upshot is that, you know, it's very unusual for humans to be able to live together in peace and to have transitions from one administration to the next. There's something that is so intoxicating about power. People will risk everything up to their own life and the lives of everybody that they know, everybody in their country, to have power. Look at what's happening in Syria now. It's happened so many times in history that we've accepted it as being natural, but really it's not natural whatsoever to go and kill people so you can stay in power. Obama is putting the American Republic at risk by fighting this transition. And it just goes to show you that all the 8 years that he was in office, that you thought he was just a normal guy, he just maybe a little bit to the left, maybe he's just kind of got a black take on the Democratic Party or whatever, however you explained it to yourself, just slightly different. He was actually the whole time a Marxist, and all of the stuff that he did that seemed like accidental mistakes that harmed America, he didn't really seem to be doing it on purpose, you know what I mean? And all the stuff that he did without ever really explaining it, like the perpetual flood of illegals across the border and the use of American infrastructure and personnel to help them get relocated against the law, and all the other things that he did were not on accident. They were meant to undermine the Republic. And now that we're dealing with this, he's more out in the open. Now, I think he's a fool for doing this. He should have had somebody else, do it for him, but he doesn't care. The guy has spent an entire 8 years in office, obviously not caring. But when he does show that he cares about something, supposedly, it's creepy, it's weird. When he squeezed that tear out over the demand for gun regulations, I'm thinking this guy's a psychopath, sociopath, you know, to be able to cry on command like that when he doesn't show any emotions other than walking around with this robotic smile on his face all the time. Anyway, here's more Paul Sperry. Obama has trained tens of thousands of leftist at Alinsky camps. We are in the fight for our lives. We've got to support the president, because in supporting the president, we support the republic. There is no such thing as throwing Donald Trump out through popular dissent and saving the republic. These people don't care. Have you noticed that? They don't care. The Nancy Pelosi's and the Harry Reid's don't care what happens to the country as long as they get their progressive changes. I mean, it's really nuts what's going on. Here we go.
Now, Paul Sperry, New York Post columnist, author of The Great American Bank Robbery, and he is writing on what is the resistance, the shadow government being formed by Barack Obama. And first, Paul, thank you very much, and my congratulations on outstanding reporting. I wonder to what degree the national liberal media will even pay an ounce of attention. Will they have the courage, the principle, to report on the things that you and I are talking about here tonight?
Well, of course not. I mean, you got an Obama-friendly media, and they're going to try and cover this up and keep it on the QT as long as they can, so that Obama can get this, like I was calling it in the column, a shadow government, build this up. I don't think Republicans know what they're up against here. He's quietly building this shadow opposition government to sabotage Trump and Republicans as well in their policies, while at the same time saving his own legacy. And he's doing all this through a radical Alinsky group that he founded called Organizing for Action, OFA.
Right.
And they've got an army of agitators, and they are going to they're fanning out. They're going to hit Republicans even harder next week when they go home for recess back to their home districts.
Right. And we're watching some of that unfold in the congressional town hall meetings, some of it being styled as Republicans and conservatives rising up against their Republican or conservative representatives, which is utter nonsense, as we both know. How serious do you believe this is? We're talking about, as you suggest in the column, something north of 30,000 people in OFA. And you know, they didn't even tip their hat. It could have been Organizing for America, but it had to be for action. Where is this headed?
Right. Well, they took it out of the Obama campaign in 2012. It was part of that campaign, and they turned it into a 501c4 so they don't have to show their donors. And what they're doing, so basically starts at a training center, and they put these aren't like the rabble from Occupy Wall Street, right, or even Black Lives Matter. These are professionally trained agitators. They're schooled in Alinsky's Rat Rules for Radicals tactics at a program that lasts 6 weeks. And that's about 32,000 who have gone through that, over 32,000. They've got another 25,000. We're under training now, and they've got another big training summit coming up in March, and we haven't seen the worst of these protests. These are really going to hit hard. But Obama's the guy who's behind all this. He's the mastermind. If you look at his website, down in the little print, his new website,
right,
post presidency, little agate type down there, two organizations listed. One is, I don't know if you can see this, OFA,
right,
Organizing for Action. The other is the Obama Foundation. And eventually, he wants to merge them. And if they can get the DNC, which Obama wants to get his guy Tom Perez, this radical civil rights chief he had,
right,
in the helm at the DNC, you get all this together. And then they get the proprietary database of the voters from OFA, which is licensed, and they've never shared that before with the DNC. You get the email list, millions of Obama supporters from OFA, and you get the donor list. And once the DNC gets that, you have a superstructure. And that's going to be a formidable organizing infrastructure.
And around that organizing superstructure that will be unprecedented, you already have many, if not most, of the technology. The large technology firms are already in alliance with him, as is the national left-wing media, as is the national left-wing academia, our colleges and universities, and of course
really
the left-wing media. And so it is an extraordinary development, and they mean business when it comes to obstructing and bringing down this administration. Paul, we would like you to come back.
All right. So what is going on is very scary. And, you know, the the sad thing is that, you know, the sad thing to me anyway is that this is totally unnecessary. This is not fundamentally about Donald Trump. Donald Trump just happens to be in the midst of this battle over power. It could be anybody. I mean, the idea that, that Trump is uniquely evil and has to be treated like a Hitler entering office is one of the most hilarious things I've ever heard. But because people in this country are so lazy and so indifferent, because that's how we were educated. We were educated to take things for granted, to think that the media didn't have a reason to lie to us, to think that the government was always our buddy, and to just become these little puppets of propaganda. And the number of people who are fighting for this, think of all the disenfranchised, the people who feel disenfranchised by the election, the people that are upset. Some small percentage of those people are going to go into the OFA, but the rest of the people are all just sitting ducks for this stuff. You take your frustration, and this is not about logic. I have this friend that I cannot train to call me at any other time, but she called me last night at 11 o'clock, and we started talking about this stuff, and I was trying to explain to her, Obama is a bad man. He's a bad person. All of this stuff, all the protests that are going on are on purpose. And the people, even all of these brilliant academics and brilliant authors and law professors and politicians who are very seasoned to dealing with people are getting sucked up into this. And they think it is a legitimate movement, and it's actually AstroTurf. It is actually a bunch of created impressions. This is like Brave New World. This is like 1984. They're using the media machine and the hype bubble to spray out these emotions. And it is one of the weirdest and most dangerous things I've ever seen. And it's just starting, folks. 632 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. I'm glad I'm here to talk to you about it, but it is a time to, it's time to take the measure of ourselves and get involved in fighting back against it. We'll be right back. We're going to listen, by the way, to the Eagles this week. All right, so everybody wants to be involved in some level of some great event, right? Everybody wants their life to be. I've kind of watched this in other people. People want to. They want to believe they're living in important times, right? Every generation of the church has believed, for example, that the apocalypse was right around the corner, and people in secular regimes in Germany and in Russia and China thought that they were auguring in some extraordinary new human history instead of the evil and total destruction that they did bring in. Hitler famously said his new republic would last for 1,000 years. People who are religious, people who are not religious, want to be involved in something that is epic, that makes their life not just a little period of marking time between birth and death. They want their names to be etched into history. They want to, right? So not to overdevelop this idea. So I think that these people that are going after Trump think that they're on this giant movement for human freedom, and it's called liberalism. Or globalism, whatever you want to call it, progressivism. socialism. And so instead, what they're doing is they're going after the elements of democracy and the rule of law and republicanism, and they're trying to destroy all of these institutions so that no one can stop them. And so it is a time of self-delusion. It is a time that reveals that we have not been taught, we've not taught ourselves, and we were not taught in school how to think. And these little puppets are out there, you know, just vomiting up these talking points. It's sad because the number of people who think that they're doing something good in these movements is to a very high degree. And what they're actually doing is sowing the seeds of the destruction of the greatest country in the history of the world. It's a very sad thing. Here's Lou Dobbs, Obama looking very close to the sedition. Here's my question for you. Will there come a time, has it already come, when the government needs to go after Obama, when he needs to be arrested for doing this? Because if this continues, the entire country is going to go into, or I think is in danger of going into a revolution or a civil war. Should we let this one guy, the same way that we let George Soros attack and undermine our country, should we let this one guy, Obama, send out his protesters to overturn a lawful, legal election so that he can have what he wants, one person? Should he be arrested and charged with sedition, the attempt to overthrow the government? Here's a little more from Lou Dobbs.
Barack Obama, who many claim will be creating a shadow government to frustrate the policy goals of this administration. We're looking at something that's coming very close, it seems to me, to sedition. When you start working against the interest of the United States government, whether it's in the person of Donald Trump or whomever, and conspiring and organizing to frustrate the policies that he intends to execute, I think that that really takes us to a whole nother level. What do you think?
I agree, and it started with the playbook when the Democrats just had their retreat. They called it their retreat as to how they're going to disrupt the government of the United States and make sure that Donald J. Trump, president, doesn't get anything done. I think, Lou, what they're doing is they're playing with dynamite here, and they're just begging us to get rid of the filibuster, not only on the Supreme Court, but frankly, get rid of the filibuster on legislation. That's something I would support. And if we do that, they become totally irrelevant. Let Senator Schumer and the others do anything they can. Absent the filibuster, they become irrelevant. We move this country forward faster than anyone ever would think possible. Yeah. We achieve success for the American public, and the Democrats will be wandering lost in the desert for a very long time.
Well, and with that, the country being restored again to safety, security, to prosperity, and great again, I think is the expression we're looking for here. Congressman, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Always good to be with you, Lou.
Congressman Chris Collins.
All right. I've got some weather here for you now. There was a weather event in San Antonio. A lot of homes were damaged. A lot of buildings were damaged. They think it was a tornado. We have some extraordinary weather going on across the United States. Currently, we are waiting to come ashore one of the greatest storms in the history of California. Oroville Dam is supposed to get up to 10 inches of rain from this thing. I called my sister last night, and she said, well, the only thing that she had seen in the last day was high winds. Well, this next storm coming on land is supposed to have over 100-mile-an-hour winds. So there's blizzards that are up in the northeast. So you've got epic storms. And what is the deal with the Weather Channel, by the way? You've got the most populous state in the nation, and they barely have any coverage of it. I don't get it. But here is, anyway, looking for the local weather here before I send you into these other ones. Hold on one second. And I think we're going to have a good weather day, but let's just check her out here. So 39 and clear right now. High today 63, low tonight 36, and mostly sunny and starting to get warmer. Blizzards now across the northeast, and storm buries parts of New England with 40 inches of snow. And heavy, heavy thunderstorms coming up through Texas. So we're going to have on the left side storm clouds and storms coming from the left, and they're already over Nevada and Arizona. And they're going to be coming in here just a little bit. On the other hand, you've got on the West Coast, you have a lot of ton of rain coming in. So, and Los Angeles may be setting a record for the amount of rain that they've gotten in one day. So here is first the California story. Hold on just a second. And this is from the Weather Channel.
California saw additional rain over the weekend, and of course, this just aggravated the flood situation even more. And as we go through the first couple of days through the work week, we are definitely concerned about even more aggravation as rain works in once more across northern and central California. So we've got plenty of moisture, and we want to show you the locations that are included under flood watches. That's in the lighter shade of green, and the flood warnings. The warnings, of course, showing where flooding is either already occurring or imminent. We're going to be talking about rainfall rates that could be 1 inch per hour, heavy snow as well for the mountains. Northern and central California, 3 to 5 inches, but a lot more in the foothills. So flooding, mudslides, debris flows, all a concern once again. And this will carry over not just into Tuesday, but even into early Wednesday. We'll be still tallying up that rainfall and, of course, the snowfall amounts. Here's a look at the rain and snow forecast through Wednesday for much of the Northwest, extending down to Northern California. And here are the amounts, which you see are a bit lighter as we extend into Southern California.
And San Francisco gets 3 to 5 inches, and Oroville gets 2 to 3 inches. So that's not as much as they had thought. And Santa Rosa, California got 4 inches in 24 hours. And then that's not even touching what's going on in LA, which I have a little clip for you here from AccuWeather. And of course, now it won't start. I'll just dump that. But they were showing the Los Angeles River just about overflowing its banks. Now, here is on the storm in San Antonio. And this is, again, from the Weather Channel. This morning,
severe weather swept through San Antonio, Texas, and other parts of the Lone Star State as we went from late Sunday night into the early morning hours of Monday. At least 3 potential tornadoes, and they damaged more than 100 structures and caused some minor injuries. Now, a lot of the damaged buildings were homes, but there was also an elementary school north of San Antonio that was damaged in the storm. More than 40,000 customers were also without power at the height of the outages around San Antonio. Here's a quick look at the radar recap from Sunday night going into Monday.
And it looked like the amount of rain that came down there was pretty heavy too. Okay, 6:45, Kelly O'Connell. We're talking about the shadow government that Obama is trying to force in or has brought in, and he's trying to attack every single thing that Trump has done. You think that Obama is a good guy? You got frustrated with me over the years listening to me trash him? Well, every single thing that I ever said about him and more has proved to be true. We'll be right back. 523-1450 if you want to disagree. All right, so what is Organizing for Action? That is Obama's OFA group. Here, check this out. This is the group that's driving all of these protesters, is organizing them across the country and in D.C. and in various cities, wherever the need is at the time.
I'm Allison Barber with the Washington Free Beacon. Tonight, President Obama will appear before Organizing for Action, a new outside money group aimed at picking up for the Obama reelection.
By the way, this is 4 years old.
Campaign left off. The president will speak at the so-called Founder Summit to a group of campaign donors and activists in a Washington, D.C. hotel. You may hear the name OFA and immediately think of presidential elections, and you wouldn't be wrong. In 2008, OFA stood for Obama for America. Since 2009, it's been known as Organizing for America. It was the major driving force behind Obama's reelection campaign. Today, OFA stands for Organizing for Action. The new OFA is a 501c4, which allows it to accept unlimited donations, unlike the DNC. There's been a lot of discrepancy in terms of what role the new organization will play. We know that OFA still runs the Twitter and Facebook accounts of both the president and the first lady, as well as the website barackobama.com. OFA insists that they're nonpartisan and says that they're an issue advocacy group, not an electoral one, but not everyone agrees. A lot of people have expressed frustration at the group's existence, noting that it seems to be the very pay-to-play politics President Obama promised to disband. Contributors who donate or raise $500,000 are reportedly allowed to have quarterly meetings with the president, which has led critics to point out that this is essentially auctioning off access to the president of the United States. Tonight's donors paid $50,000 to attend the meeting. You can learn more about this at freebeacon.com, where we have a new infographic that will walk you through all of the information. I'm Allison Barber. Thanks for watching.
The same thing that Hillary Clinton was doing. No wonder he didn't do it. Well, he wasn't bothered by it. Here's a little bit more on this OFA.
Organizing for Action is a nonprofit group that grew out of former President Barack Obama's 2008 win. But this morning, it's back in the spotlight, ramping up its efforts to tear down President Trump's agenda. In a recently released video, the organization, with a special appearance by President Obama, calls for change.
Nothing's more powerful than millions of voices
calling for change.
We've seen it.
We've seen it.
Yes, it's true. We are community organizers.
And we're actually really proud of it.
This movement is the single greatest threat to the way that the powerful interests in Washington do business.
But it depends on you.
So what influence have they had in the growing anti-Trump movement we see in all these town halls? And should the former president be that closely involved, or is he? Through the debate that Matt Schlapp, chairman of the American Conservative Union, and Danielle McLaughlin, liberal commentator and author of The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. First off, Danielle, is it your belief that President Obama on the beach is pulling the strings?
No, President Obama is on the beach kite surfing, and I think trying to forget about the pressures of the presidency for a little while. I think there's no question that when he comes back to the States, he's going to set up shop back in D.C. where his children are preliminarily anyway. And I think he will be involved to some extent in Democratic politics. I think he wants to build a bench of young Democrats.
This woman is lying her rear end off. She's either totally deluded or she's just another leftist, what do they call them? The foolish leftists who help push forward Marxism, useful idiots.
Who will do what he started? He cares about progressive ideas. He cares about affordable health care. He cares about a growing and strong middle class, and he cares about energy independence. So I think we'll see that.
Ben, there's a sense of these uprisings in these town halls, these demonstrations from Minneapolis to North Carolina to New York and San Francisco over the weekend are orchestrated by this group.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And let me just say, I think it's President Obama just can't get enough. It's very graceless to continue to want to be at the front and center of politics even after you've been president. I mean, the fact that he's already commented several times in an attacking fashion against President Trump, just I think it's revealing of his character. And I think he's absolutely wanting to be. Look, they're going to have a big race to see who the next head of the DNC is. I think it's Barack Obama. I think he is pulling strings. I think he is involved. And I think he's going to be the head of the Democratic resistance throughout these Trump years. And I think it's very tacky.
Danielle, you saw how devastated he was and the look on his whole staff's face when Donald Trump won. And there's a sense that there was a plan put in place at that moment to really make Donald Trump's administration implode. And now there's some talk that baby Ben Rhodes is behind the ousting of Mike Flynn and some of the orchestration of some of the things that came out, because Mike Flynn was the biggest critic of the Iranian deal.
Well, I think we need to separate fact from fiction. OFA, which is the organization that we're talking about here, was founded in 2012, 2013, after he was President Obama was reelected. And so this is a long-term plan for progressive values. I don't think the president wants to be president anymore. And in his farewell address, he talked about the power of people. He talked about the idea that we should be defending our own first freedoms, our own Bill of Rights. I think that's what he's going to do. I don't see him getting too delving into politics too much.
But Matt, he did tweet out right away how proud he was about the demonstrations that he was seeing.
He appears in this video. He is standing side by side with the people going to these town halls. He is trying to defend the only real legislative item in his legacy, Brian, and that's Obamacare. And he is very engaged in trying to keep it, even though the American people have never really accepted it, and it's very unpopular. And because of Obamacare and the other parts of the radical agenda, the Democrats never lost so much than under President Obama.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, so we know this is going on. We don't need this lady to sit there and lie to us, but it is going to be growing. I think that Obama is always wanted to do this from when he got into power. He was thinking of how to keep his, not just his legacy, but his ideas, his movement going. We'll take a break here, and we're very close to the break on the hour. All right, check this out. Here's a little bit on Saul Alinsky. Listen to this. This is from Mike Wallace in The Day.
His name is Saul Alinsky, and there are still many to whom the name is meaningless. But to millions now, he is looked on as a savior. And these are the so-called have-nots, the culturally deprived, the abject poor. They love him, and they ask him in to organize their weakness into a strength and power that has become a frightening threat to the establishment.
I suppose, given a choice, I think I would pick hell. The reason I'd pick hell is because that's where all the have-nots are.
So Saul Alinsky is doing something that I mentioned to you before. He identifies with Satan. He identifies with hell. Given the chance to go to heaven or hell, he'd go to hell and organize it, according to him. 6:59, and that's what they're trying to do, is turn America into hell right now. Sounds like an overstatement. It's not. We'll be right back. It's 7:06, and we were going over in the first hour some of the crazy things that have been going on. And here's the basic news for you. The left and the right deal differently with loss. And if you haven't figured that out yet, you need to accept it now, because it's radically true. No pun intended, or pun intended. They're going to do everything they can to destroy Trump. Now, they've got this movement now, HWNDU. You'll see that and you'll think, what is that? He will not divide us. So this is the movement. We're talking about the possibility of millions of Americans, millions of people on the far left who feel that they have nothing left to lose in terms of speaking truth to power, is what I'm sure they'll call it. And what it's going to end up being is an attempt to delegitimize Trump. It's already happening. And to take away his rightfully won presidency. There is no evidence that the Russians overthrew the outcome of the election. But, you know, the left is not really worried about that. What they're worried about is that in some weird way, and I actually did an article on this, the left has taken over the idea of natural law. The right has abandoned the natural law. They don't really talk about it anymore. Their Supreme Court nominees don't discuss it. Apparently, it's too inconvenient. There would be no America without the natural law. There'd be no Constitution or Bill of Rights, because those are natural law ideas and elements, but which is why you can't go beyond them. No matter what the situation, what the law, you cannot go beyond the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But the left has now adopted the idea of natural law, though they will never call it that, because they reject the centerpiece of the natural law, which is the Bible. And what they have in their mind as the natural law is liberalism, socialism. All right, now here is from their manual for action in their attack against Trump. This is from Facebook. Take a deep breath, then take action. This is Organizing for Action. This is the group that Obama put together, and he's running to destroy Donald Trump right now. And what can Donald Trump do against this guy? If he were to go and try to arrest him or cite him for inciting violence and take him to court, wouldn't there be the most incredible reaction? How dare you disturb this great man who's no longer in office? And this is from Thursday, February 9th, 2017. So this is less than 2 weeks ago. Every week, it seems like the current administration and Congress are just going through a list of issues progressive organizers care most about and dedicating their efforts to rolling back our hard-won progress. And it's not just on big-ticket items like Obamacare. They're also going after lesser-known common-sense measures, such as those that make it harder for the mentally ill to buy a gun and a rule that prevented financial advisors from bilking their customers' retirement savings. It's troubling to see years of progress and hard work on the line, but here's how community organizers get through it. We take action. Keep in mind that progress never comes served on a silver platter. We've always had to work for it. From marriage equality to climate change to healthcare reform, it's taken years, sometimes decades, of sustained effort from a broad base of citizens to bring these issues to the forefront and persuade decision makers to move forward. So in that sense, the new political climate is no different. All right, so here's a few ways that they want to block Trump and overturn his election. Sign the petition and there is somebody called the Invisible Guide, or there's something called the Invisible Guide. Maybe this is it. I have to do some more research. Then call key senators. Then write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper. Then share your personal story at acaworks.org. All right. So one of the, you know, some of the stuff that they've, you heard what they're supposed to be doing is to be going to these events and throwing up protests, but they want to make it seem this is where the natural law idea comes in, this idea that democracy is made out of individual decision makers. So if you make it seem like there is a reaction across America to rise up and throw off Trump because he's such a Hitler, he's so terrible, You're seeding out this idea, kind of this misrepresentation of democracy, that since so many people are opposed to him, it is therefore legitimate and lawful to oppose Trump and even try to get him out of office. And Nicholas Kristof, who's a columnist for the New York Times, that once great paper that has completely fallen apart on attacking Trump and other Republicans, he said, what can we do to get him out? Now, here's a columnist. Trump is in office for a couple of weeks. A columnist takes to, I guess he's been in office now for 1 month, a columnist of the most powerful paper in the United States saying that it is a fact that Donald Trump is bad and needs to go. I mean, setting aside the fact that the guy just got here, what do you think is motivating him? He's motivated by this sense, this totally fabricated sense that socialism is rising up and demanding, like the natural law, it's rising up and demanding support. Now, I take a break here, and I'll come back, and I'm going to read you the top 10 reasons that people are resisting Trump that I came up with last night. Here's a little bit of Eagles' New Kid in Town, dedication to Donald Trump. We'll be right back. 7:13. You don't have to support Trump directly to fight for him, because in fighting for him, we're fighting for the Constitution. Sounds like overkill, sounds like over the top, overly dramatic. It's not. If these people win, America as you used to know it will be gone, and they'll be happy, but the rest of the world is going to suffer. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. Be right back.
There's talk on the street, it sounds so familiar. Great expectations, everybody's watching you. People you meet, they all seem to know you. Even your old friends treat you like a second male.
All right, so we've got this 30,000 man, 32,000 man and woman army that is being set up or is already set up. These people were previously Barack Obama supporters. Now he's got them. They've been to Alinsky training camp, and now they're ready for battle. They're training 32,000 more, and so here's the idea. All of these people who get trained in the Alinsky camp are getting trained to come out and they're radicalized and radicalize others. You could have millions of people who are taking part in this giant army. So let me ask you this. What's the purpose? In the natural law, and the theory of the natural law was that there's a law above the law, and you ignore it at your peril, that you have to bring it into your own laws and organizations. And it wasn't exactly applying the Levitical law of the Old Testament on human beings, but it was to take the principles, the Ten Commandments, the basic arguments behind the laws of the Jews, because many were abrogated. Many of the 600 laws in the Old Testament were abrogated. That means that they were made invalid. But the idea behind natural law was that you were going to bring that into human society and make it a better society. Here you've got socialism being treated as the natural law. And if it doesn't come in through democracy in the Republican way, as it did with Obama and his approach, then you are absolutely right to bring it in any other way you want, including through radicalism, including through protests and uprisings and throwing off popular elections and demanding that the rule of law be set aside so that these socialist principles can be put into place. I know it sounds either like something you don't want to think about or a little too far over the top, but I mean, I don't really understand how to explain it other than that. Here is a little bit from Hannity talking about the sedition that's being pumped out. Sedition is when you try to overthrow the government as part of a society, a state. Check this out. Yeah, just a second here.
Welcome to Hannity and tonight's special counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, will join us. But first, Democrats and the old radical left are pouncing on the resignation of Donald Trump's national security advisor, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. But there's a major part of this story that the mainstream media will not tell you about. And what's really going on here is what tonight's opening monologue is all about. So liberals, they're predictably wasting very little time trying to create a political firestorm over Flynn stepping down. Let's be clear. It was wrong that Flynn misled the president and vice president about his phone call with a Russian ambassador. He owned up to it. He did the right thing. He stepped down. But there's something much bigger here and much darker going on. And that's been part of the alt-radical left and their master plan to damage and destroy the president, Donald Trump, and frankly, as collateral damage, anyone connected to him. This is about the left willing to do anything to stop President Trump from draining the swamp and changing the status quo and all the bureaucracy in Washington. And that means the media bureaucracy, that means the liberal bureaucracy, the lobbyist bureaucracy, et cetera. The DC swamp is rising up. They're colluding and viciously fighting to take down the 45th president and his entire administration. It's that serious. Now, the alt-radical left is hell-bent on annihilating everybody around the president, from his top advisors like Kellyanne Conway, Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, Steve Miller, even Dr. Sebastian Gorka, to even the president's own children, including the media's attack his 10-year-old son.
Mike Flynn was already a very divisive and unusual choice for this job because he's such a, it's kind of a consensus building position, and his background is really as a hothead. He's already a kind of a divisive force within this White House.
So, Stephen Miller, let's take you to class for a second here, because I know you didn't go to law school. I don't know what type of school you went to, but they certainly didn't teach you civics. You're unworthy to be in the White House. You're unworthy to be in government if that's what you believe, unless it's Vladimir Putin's government.
Saturday Night Live really did portray him just about as he is. I mean, he is an embarrassment even to Trump. And so I don't know how long he's going to last.
It's a stunning thing that a white supremacist, Bannon, would be a permanent member of National Security Council.
See this? One by one, in true Saul Alinsky form, the left and liberals in the mainstream media have been systematically going down the line of people close to President Trump and trying to take each and every one of them out.
You delegitimize people. You take away their sense of authority by showing that they're a bad person. And then you put pressure on the president or whoever to remove people. Now that they've seen they can get rid of somebody from Trump, then they're really going after it. Now, here is a little clip from Saul Alinsky. I want to spend the next half of an hour looking into George Washington. We're celebrating, in a sense, his birthday today, President's Day. But here's Saul Alinsky saying, I'd organize hell. Now, think about this. All of these people in the French Revolution, all of these people that came out, the socialists that came out of the French Revolution, a lot of them dedicated their writing to Satan. Because Satan was the underdog. Satan was this person who was on earth working to help mankind, supposedly. And God is up in heaven. And given a chance, Saul Alinsky said he'd go to hell and organize that. Don't forget, by the way, Saul Alinsky was taught how to organize by the Catholic Church. The far left elements in the Catholic Church in Chicago, believe it or not. Check this out. Here's Saul Alinsky's interview from Mike Wallace in 1966.
His name is Saul Alinsky, and there are still many to whom the name is meaningless. But to millions now, he is looked on as a savior. And these are the so-called have-nots, the culturally deprived, the abject poor. They love him, and they ask him in to organize their weakness into a strength and power that has become a frightening threat to the establishment.
Well, there is. I suppose, given a choice, I think I would pick hell. The reason I'd pick hell is because that's where all the have-nots are.
He is disarmingly mild when you meet him. But there is an implacable ferocity about him which is directed at many forces he considers to be at the root of human suffering and misery.
I'm all for it. I think our Air Force and our Army should, after they finish in Vietnam, should come back and bomb the hell out of Mississippi, you know? What would it be? Southern Mississippi instead of Northern Mississippi. So we can all get freedom and equality down there, too.
He has called the war on poverty political pornography and says those who run the program represent the greatest feeding trough that has come along for the welfare industry in years. There are always repercussions whenever Saul Alinsky moves into an afflicted ghetto with his Industrial Areas Foundation, perhaps because it is felt he may get some results quicker than the established authorities, whom he ridicules for their boondoggle. He can be scornful of an entire city with one scathing comment.
If you ask me, one thing which Los Angeles really needed above anything else, I would say what it needs is a massive enema.
He is one of the few men who appears to be absolutely fearless, especially when it comes to the constant threats he receives by telephone and in the mail.
Death threats? I'll probably get knocked off. I think with all this notoriety and all this stuff that goes up, that there's always some kooky crackpot who will say, you know, I'll get national headlines by knocking them off, which you will, you know.
This, then, is an opening frame that we put around the self-portrait of one of the most controversial figures in today's gallery of American radicals. On this KPIX report, Saul Alinsky will share with you his searching personal assessment of himself, as he did with us in this exclusive half hour titled I'd Organize Hell.
Well, we don't have time for that, but you know, Saul Alinsky, I think, is an example of the kind of that you get these Jewish intellectuals that don't really have any kind of a belief in God. They're religious in a cultural sense, but they're not religious in the sense of religion, personal deity or anything. And so they end up getting involved in, a lot of these people get involved in socialism as something to replace the fact that they have no religion. 728. Here is a little bit from Rules for Radicals.
It is Alinsky's power tactics for which Rules for Radicals is most famous. They are as follows. Power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. Never go outside the experience of your people. Wherever possible, go outside the experience of the enemy. Make the enemy live up to their own book of rules. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. A good tactic is one that your people enjoy. A tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. Keep the pressure on. The threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. The major premise for tactics is the development of operations that will maintain a constant pressure on the opposition. If you push a negative hard and deep enough, it will break through to its counterside. The price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. And finally, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. So beginning at the start, power is as much about perception as it is ability. If your enemy thinks you have power that you do not have, not only can you take advantage of that, you can use their beliefs to help understand their worldview. Contrast this with the worldview of your side, so you can ensure that you know the limits of the experience of your people and theirs. To make the enemy live up to their own set of rules is to demand that they adhere to an unrealistic standard that they have theoretically pledged to adhere to. This is, of course, impossible, as nobody lives up to the letter of their own rules, merely the spirit. When they fail this, turn to ridicule, as there is rarely a good response to being mocked, and to get your opponent emotionally excited increases the chances that they will make a mistake. It's also likely that ridicule will be a tactic that your people enjoy and rarely becomes a drag, but you can't keep making the same joke over and over. You have to constantly find new things to mock. If you're lucky, your enemy will have many qualities that can be mocked, but either way, don't give them time to regroup. If they are on the defensive, keep going because, as Alinsky says, the threat is usually more terrifying, because power is often about perception. Living with the terrifying event is often easy enough after the fact, but the fear and pressure will force your opponent's hand. This should be the point of all tactical operations of the organization.
All right, that's a little bit from the Rules for Radicals. Take a break here and come back and get something wholesome. A little bit of the life of George Washington, first president.
lately. The new kid in town. Everybody loves you. So don't let them.
Well, believe it or not, George Washington was actually a bit of a Trump in his day. And the reason that I say that is he was one of the wealthiest people in the colonies and put all that on the line to lead the country. Here is from the Biography Channel. George Washington, his birthday was the 22nd of February. It was normally celebrated on this Monday. But it's been changed to President's Day for some stupid reason. Here we go.
George Washington was a Virginia gentleman and a great soldier who became the father of his country.
George Washington, the first United States president, was born in Westmoreland County, Virginia, on February 22nd, 1732. He came from a prominent family.
He had a very regal bearing. Washington's property holdings were extensive.
He was homeschooled until the age of 16, when he left home to help map the boundaries of the English colony of Virginia. Then in 1752, his brother and his niece both died, and the 20-year-old Washington inherited his family's fortune, including their home in Mount Vernon, Virginia.
George Washington was a slave owner. He had hundreds of slaves.
In 1753, when the French began seizing British territory in the American colonies, Washington, a major in the Virginia militia, was sent to defend the Crown's claims.
Washington fought against the French and the Indians in the 1750s when he was a British officer.
He led several military campaigns, and after the British won the war, he sought an officer's commission in the British Army.
He was turned down for a leadership position in the British military and was embittered by that.
In 1758, Washington left the militia and returned to Mount Vernon. Within 1 month, he married wealthy widow Martha Custis.
Martha, along with the property, made him one of the wealthiest leaders in Virginia and in the country.
Washington was elected to Virginia's House of Burgesses. He began to oppose the growing tax burden Britain was imposing on the colony.
America felt that Britain, its mother country, was exploiting it for taxation and not giving it the freedom that it deserved to chart its own course.
George Washington was not a Patrick Henry or a Sam Adams or a Thomas Paine, any of the fervent extremists, if you will, who were leading the revolution. He was a more reluctant convert.
In March 1775, Washington was elected to the First Continental Congress. 1 month later, the Revolutionary War began.
Washington was literally the man on horseback who rode back to the Second Continental Congress, ready to take charge of the Patriot Army.
In March 1776, Washington's army won its first victory, beating the British in Boston. The British evacuated Boston, and Washington moved his army to New York City. But within months, Washington was forced to flee New York City.
George Washington lost battle after battle, but he never lost the war. He always lived to fight again another day.
On Christmas night, 1776, Washington attacked the British.
George Washington was a guerrilla leader, and he crossed over the Delaware River. He was using guerrilla tactics, stealth, to do it, and no one was expecting it to happen.
Washington defeated the British in Princeton and Trenton, but following those victories was a long, harsh winter for the Continental Army.
Valley Forge was the low point. That cold, bleak winter, they were walking barefoot in the snow. Washington's strategy was all about making it for another day.
Washington won the last major conflict of the Revolutionary War in October 1781 with the surrender of the British fleet at Yorktown. In 1783, with the war over, Washington resigned and went home to Mount Vernon.
Washington is pulled back into the political fray, back into Philadelphia in that hot summer of 1787, where they carve out the new Constitution. And he agreed to become president to help unify this new nation.
On April 30th, 1789, George Washington was sworn in as the first president of the United States.
Washington was the only man unanimously elected on the Electoral College.
Washington led the young nation from the Capitol in New York City, serving two terms as president.
Washington understood that for the democracy to be really a real democracy and for there to be popular rule and not rule by kings, he had to give up power. He had to set the example of the chief executive who voluntarily gives up power and goes home.
On December 14, 1799, George Washington died.
When he died, he freed his slaves. He emancipated them upon his death. So Washington was, even in death, the unifying man.
All right, here's a little bit more from the site, The U.S. Presidents, on George Washington, first president.
George Washington was the first president of America. He helped to establish the federal government and aspired to create a free, democratic, and united country. He was born on February 22, 1732, in Westmoreland County, Virginia, and was the eldest son of Augustine and Mary Ball Washington, who were prosperous Virginia gentry of English descent. George Washington died on Saturday, December 14, 1799, at his Mount Vernon estate in Virginia. The career of George Washington included the roles of a surveyor, farmer, soldier, politician, and statesman. He was the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the American Revolution. He became the first president of America in 1789 and served for 8 years until 1797. George Washington married Martha Dandridge Custis in 1759. She was a wealthy widow with two children whose names were Jackie and Patsy. George and Martha never had any children together. George Washington belonged to the Federalist Political Party. He was 57 years old when he was inaugurated as the first American president. John Adams stood as the vice president. He was the only president who was unanimously elected and ran unopposed for both his terms of office. He was descended from English royalty and became one of the richest men in America, owning a considerable number of slaves. He was an imposing figure, standing at 6 feet, 1.5 inches. He was also a brave commander and fought in the wars against the French and Indians. In recognition of his lifetime achievements, George Washington has appeared on the 25-cent piece since 1932. During his lifetime, he played a key role in major events of the era. George Washington was instrumental in the American Revolution, in which the American colonists won independence from British rule, the 1791 Bill of Rights, and forming the Constitution of the USA. During his life, George Washington suffered from malaria, smallpox, tuberculosis, dysentery, and pneumonia. This was not unusual for this time period, as medical knowledge was in its infancy. What is surprising is that he survived these illnesses and lived to the age of 67. He died of pneumonia together with an infection of the larynx that resulted in suffocation on December 14, 1799 at his Mount Vernon estate. On the centenary of his death, there was a move to have his body moved to a crypt in Washington, but this idea was strongly resisted in the South, and he was therefore placed in a new, bigger tomb at Mount Vernon. The key to the tomb was symbolically thrown into the Potomac River. So ends our short biography about the life and presidency of George Washington.
All right, let's take a little break here. Fascinating person. You couldn't spend enough time studying this guy. We'll be right back. 523-1450, you're listening to AM Las Cruces. Kelly O'Connell.
You look in her eyes, the music begins to play. Hopeless romance, here we go again. But after a while, you look in the other way. It's those restless hearts that never mend.
Folks, so let's get into this here. It is George Washington, a man of character, a little speech on his personality and life, and Freedom Project Media is putting this out.
We're here today to talk about George Washington, a man of character. George Washington's impact on American history, heritage, and culture were enormous. And virtually any honest history of George Washington must include the facts of his life, the respect and admiration of both friend and foe, the absolute virtue of his personal life, the remarkable consistency of his conduct, the deep faith that he exhibited,
and the enduring example of his leadership. Sadly, much of the example of our first president, and in my opinion, our greatest leader, has been lost slowly in an erosion of our educational systems, increasing attacks on our nation's heritage and history, and the ignorance of our people. If you will make a study of the man, his life and his actions, and his personal character, you will come away with an amazing picture of a man. A man who is truly and literally larger than life, not only in his performance and accomplishments, but in his faith and in his personal testimony. He was a man who was, in the view of his countrymen for many generations, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. George Washington, the man, was a servant as well as a leader, landowner, commander, and other things. His entire life was a life of service, and his history was marked by his service to others. In service to his family, as a child, he served his parents diligently. The stories of his hardworking and good-natured childhood are plentiful. Even men of faith who served to educate young George went away positively impressed with his good nature, his observant and keen mind, and his tender heart. George also served faithfully and diligently his beloved wife and adopted children. In service to his community, George was a valued mentor and a good neighbor and faithful friend. To many others, a large number of whom we revere today as heroes, it is well said that a man can be judged by his friends, and his were many and wonderful. Books like The Making of George Washington, now out of print, illustrate the details of the forging of his character. In his service to Virginia, Washington was an exemplary citizen, a courageous soldier, observant explorer, and an accurate surveyor, as well as a masterful and courageous leader. Many of the surveys that he did still exist, and the markers are still accurate in the surveying of lands in the Virginia area. In his service to liberty, George had no equal as a patriot, a sage political philosopher, and finally as a victorious commander against the most powerful military on earth at that time, when it came to a time of war. But especially in service to his nation, Washington shone forth as a great and wise leader, a model president, and a worldwide example of what American leadership and the American dream were really all about. Washington also lived a life of exemplary faith in conduct, business, politics, and great conflict, and as a leader. In a well-known farewell address, he told his people, "The name of American, which belongs to you in your national capacity, must always exalt the just pride of patriotism more than any appellation derived from local discriminations. With slight shades of differences, you all have the same religion." And later in that same document, he reminded them that reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. He brought faith and a godly example to his family. Both devout and diligent, he pursued godly conduct in his home and his life in every area. His business was conducted in complete transparency and honesty. His prayers for the success of his crops and others, and for his family and friends, the kind treatment of buyers, sellers, managers, and workers, and the concise delivery of product and payment were legendary among fellow landowners and residents of his area. His conduct in elected and appointed office throughout his life earned nothing but the highest respect and deference from his fellows, his superiors, those he led, and even his opponents. During the war, his conduct as a leader was praised by friend and foe, and his treatment of a vanquished enemy was unparalleled in our history. In his service to our nation as our first president, he earned the respect and admiration of a nation through his policies and actions. Even though sometimes opposed, his opponents rarely questioned his motives or his methods, as his character was impeccable. During his inauguration, Washington took the oath as prescribed by the Constitution, but added several religious components to that official ceremony. How many of you know that these items have the genesis in George Washington's inauguration? Before taking the oath of office, he summoned a Bible on which to take the oath, added the words, "So help me God," to the end of the oath, and then leaned over and kissed the Bible. As time passed after Washington's first great battle at Monongahela early in his life, several facts surfaced about which we can understand a little more of the extent to which God directly intervened in behalf of Washington. For example, a famous Indian warrior who was a leader in that battle was often heard to publicly testify that Washington, quote, was never born to be killed by a bullet. I had 17 fair fires at him with my rifle, and after all, could not bring him to the ground. Now, when one considers that a rifle aimed by an experienced marksman rarely misses its target, his utterance seems to have been prophetic, and it's evident that an invisible hand turned aside the bullets. Washington, from his boyhood to his death, was revered as the hero of that battle, and one day, while traveling toward the Western Territories to explore uninhabited regions, while near the junction of the great Kanawha and Ohio rivers, a company of Indians led by an old respected chief came to see him. A fire was kindled, and the chief spoke to Washington through an interpreter. He explained that when he heard Washington was coming to that part of the country, he set out on a long journey to meet Washington personally and speak to him about the battle 15 years earlier. Through this interpreter, he said, "I am chief and ruler over my tribes. My influence extends to the waters of the Great Lakes and the far blue mountains. I traveled a long and weary path that I might see the young warrior of the great battle. It was on the day when the white man's blood mixed with the streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief, Washington. I called to my young men and said, 'Mark, young, tall, and daring warrior. He is not of the Redcoat tribe. He hath an Indian's wisdom, and his warriors fight as we do. Himself is alone exposed. Quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies. Our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for you, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier far than we shielded you. Seeing that you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased to fire at you. I am old and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades. But ere I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen, the Great Spirit protects that man,' he said, pointing at Washington, 'and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. I am come to pay homage to the man who is the particular favorite of heaven and who can never die in battle.'" Many years later, 80 years in fact, a gold seal worn by Washington in the battle containing his initials was found on the battlefield. It had been shot off of him by a bullet. That relic is now in possession of the family. True to the Indian's voice of prophecy, Washington never was wounded in a battle. So remarkable was his escape from the numerous perils to which he was exposed during battle that mention was made by many famous preachers of the day. Reverend Samuel Davies, who later became president of Princeton University, after concluding that Washington was a military genius, added, "I may point out to the public that heroic youth, Colonel Washington, whom I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner for some important service to his country." How accurately that wish was fulfilled by Washington's life. Because of God's help and divine intervention, Washington gathered acclaim and honor from the very same field where his commander received only dishonor and ultimately death. George Washington exhibited notable command of manners and civility throughout his entire life. His attention and diligence in social matters and the attention he gave to the sensibilities and concerns of others were complete. At the age of just 14, a time when most of us struggle to get our children today to simply be civil at all, he penned 110 rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation, a list of do's and don'ts for conversation and dealings with others. It's remarkable. The Northwest Ordinance was the first federal law to address education, and it was penned in part by George Washington and certainly was signed and authorized by Washington. And the same founding fathers who drafted the First Amendment, the amendment that courts now interpret as prohibiting the presence of religious activities in public education, stated in Article 3, signed by George Washington, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. He also felt that our students and our citizens should be educated in the understanding of our republic, our constitution, our form of government. He stated, a primary object should be the education of our youth in the science of government. In a republic, what species of knowledge can be equally important and what duty more pressing on its legislature than to patronize a plan for communicating it to those who are to be the future guardians of the liberties of the country? This is a statement taken directly from the 8th State of the Union address of our first president, George Washington. From that final farewell address, George Washington stated, the acceptance of and continuance hitherto in the office to which your suffrages have twice called me have been a uniform sacrifice of inclination to the opinion of duty and to a deference for what appeared to be your desire. I constantly hoped that it would have been much earlier in my power, consistently with motives which I was not at liberty to disregard, to return to that retirement from which I had been reluctantly drawn. How many presidents at the end of two terms in office have said that they longed to return to private life, did not seek the office, and served out of duty to the people who had called them?
Anyway, we're out of time, but that's pretty much the whole thing anyway. Thanks for tuning in. Happy President's Day. We'll get into some more presidents this week, but enjoyed spending time with you this morning. If you're having a day off, enjoy it, and we'll meet back in 22 hours. Kelly O'Connell, AM, Massachusetts, AM 1450 on KOBE. Ciao.
Johnny come lately, the new kid in town. Will she still love you when you're not around? There's so many things.